And they, he said, I was told when I left the farm that I would receive instructions on what I was about to do, what I needed to do. Very much like Fox. I think in both cases, it was another example of the self breaking into the whole conscious structure of life and saying, you know, it looks like a derogation of your responsibility to do what you're doing. But this is something you must do. It's your calling. It's your summons into life. It's Ulysses. You know, he said, the wind is blowing, puffing the sails in the harbor. Come on, guys, let's go get on the boat that you have driven so much in the past, and let's go. He had a faithful wife, Penelope, who had waited for him during the whole 10 years of the Trojan War. He had a small son, Telemachus. He wanted to go through the arch. I think George Fox was one of those people. James Naylor. And there were others. There were others. A lot more could be said about that. But it seems to me that what we're talking about is this whole element of psyche, which says to the personal ego part, you have a life which is unique. Of course, it's like other lives in many collective respects, but it's unique in its purpose and its possibility. And the self, in a sense, has given to the ego the responsibility of managing conscious life. And in fact, it's as if this is the central office of the company, and this is a branch office in Iowa. And this manager, with a lot more power, communicates to this to give purpose and meaning to the work of the branch people. This doesn't, by the way, reduce the dignity of the individual life. It simply amplifies the fact that we all contain this profound psychic reality of a living element that, in a sense, knows, I have to put quotation marks around that word, I'm not quite sure if it's the right word, knows what our life means, what it needs, what its point is. Very often the ego gets distracted. It's out here in the world of many distractions. Personal life is one of those. It always struck me that George Fox never had a relationship with a woman until he met Margaret Fell. And half of the time they were married, one or both was in prison. Half of the years they had together were spent in prison. I don't mean in the same prison at the same time. At any rate, well, I think I'll just stop the story there because the story itself goes on forever and ever. And everyone has one. There's a hand over here.
From where I'm sitting, I'm very taken by the brown partial sphere that you put the green sphere on and the light and reflection on it.
This one down here?
Am I making associations that go beyond what you're hoping to use as a model?
This is a bowl that my wife made. And as I was leaving the house with my bowl, I said, could I borrow that bowl to stand the sake on? And she said, yeah, just bring it back whole. That's the story of the bowl.
Well, I think there's more.
Well, of course there is. Thank you. There's always more. There is always more. And so it's a very good point. What does the psyche rest on? Well, we've said from one point of view, ego life rests on the unconscious part of the psyche, which is by far the dominant aspect of psychic life. And I see your hand. But is there something else that we rest on? I mean, what about the totality? Is this saying something about the collective? I don't know. But to me, already the land of the self is something well beyond personal identity. It's the link with the whole life process.
Organic
life through the millennia. Yes. And I think you're making me associate to this. It's very good what you said. Where did the human aspect aggregate enough to let us talk about this? I guess we can. We have enough knowledge of astronomy nowadays that we know that planets began as hot rock at some point and have long periods of devastation and aridity and fire and brimstone before anything settles down enough for something like a life form to arise. So it may well be that unwittingly, quite unconsciously, I chose that. And it has. There's a purpose to it, because a meaning to it, because it can suggest organic life arising out of inorganic life. So, as an organic chemist, I would be much interested in this. But I have to take this into account as well. And a fact about chemistry that drives that home is that everybody's body is made of primarily carbon atoms, a lot of carbon atoms. Where did the carbon come from? Carbon is formed in the nuclei of stars by nuclear reaction. So it has been said that we are creatures made of star stuff. So I think there's a whole conference on what you roused up. So we just scratched the surface. But there was a hand over here. Yeah.
Does the collective unconscious have a dark side?
What would be your answer?
Yes. Been there.
Anybody want to argue to the contrary? No. You win. Does the unconscious, did you say the unconscious in general have a dark side?
The collective unconscious.
Well, we've said that the collective is the area of the archetype. We know about the archetype that it is a conjunctio. A conjunctio, a joined entity in which opposites are combined. We also know that the life in consciousness is life lived in the full awareness and presence of opposites. In fact, the fundamental structure of ego consciousness is resting upon the energies, the opposing energies of opposite things, cold, hot, light, dark. We would not need language if we didn't have opposites, because it would make no sense to speak of light if we didn't know about darkness, or to say cold if we didn't know about warmth. So consciousness is fundamentally constructed of the sense of oppositions. The view of the collective unconscious is that the archetypes are not split at that level. That everything unconscious is, in a certain sense, conjoined with its opposite. Now, there's a wonderful, our Bible is full of stories that make that come true, make it come clearly from a sense that ancient people understood this. Not in a rational, objective way, not as a principle of science, but as a principle of unconscious awareness. So the world is a field of opposition. And it would imply then that in the collective self, the collective unconscious self, that we have to accommodate the idea that the opposites are combined, that good is combined with evil, let's say, light with darkness.
No right or wrong.
Well, we, once again, you know, it's very tempting to try to weave some sort of idea, a collection of ideas about this with language. But we're really talking about things that are very difficult to express and perhaps impossible for us. The way I think about that often is going to stories. This is a story I probably would have used maybe Saturday or possibly even at the last lecture on Monday. But think of the think of Holy Week. Think of the baptism of Jesus. You know how that story goes. That this young rabbi comes to the cousin of his mother, John the Baptist, and says, "I want you to baptize me." And they have a little discussion. And finally, John agrees to do that. Then the baptism occurs. What happens? What happens on that occasion? The heavens open. The dove of the Holy Spirit descends. Now I'm going to ask you, is this mythopoetic thinking or is this rational, objective thinking? Toy with that a little while. Because it's by no means unanimous in any place that I've ever been, which it is. But that's what happened according to the canonical accounts in the New Testament. And not only what we said, but a voice spoke from heaven. And who knows what the voice said? Yeah. This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. I've often thought about that sentence. And I thought, I know a large number of men who've never heard anything like that. And women too, by the way. Who never heard, this is my beloved daughter or son. And I'm well pleased in them. And they had to construct a life around the absence of that kind of descent. So that's what happened to this life. On that particular occasion, the voice came, the dove came, the heavens opened. Then Jesus was baptized. What happened then? Yes. He felt a need to go off by himself for a while. And that he did. And the story, the canon says that he stayed there for 40 days. Well, 40 nights too. Yes. He did stay there. Now, why 40? Does anybody have any idea why 40? I'm sorry, can't hear. Same as the exile from Egypt, the escape from Egypt, 40 years in that case. There's a story there too, because it wasn't intended to be 40 years. At least the original persons who escaped didn't think they'd be in the Sinai 40 years. I'm digressing, but it's interesting. The Israelites who left, the Hebrews who left Egypt, left in a body, and they moved north because they'd been told they should go to Canaan and take over that land because God had reserved it for them. They still think that, by the way. So they got up to the boundary of Egyptian territory and the Canaan territory. Well, looking across the boundary, they could see other people over there. And Moses thought, what I need to do is send some reconnaissance people out. I need some intelligence here to see if it's proper to start a war in the Middle East. I need good intelligence. And he sent 12 people. And they came back and they said, well, 10 of the 12 said, don't even try it. There are too many of them. They're big. They're fierce. We will just never make it. 2 of them dissented and said, no, God said it's ours, and we think we can go get it, and we think we should go over. Well, they talked and talked, and finally Moses was furious with all this. And he said, you people don't deserve a country. God had told him this first. You're not going across any boundary right now. Turn around and head the other way. So they spent the next 38 years. So 38 years plus the 2 years it took them to get up there, 40. Well, 40 is a very important number in Hebrew numerology. It's a number that means the amount of time necessary to conclusively accomplish an important objective. 40 years. So in a certain sense, it's a mythological number. Well, Jesus was in the desert for 40 days and nights. He had a mission. What happened in the desert? Who remembers? He met a figure. Satan, the devil, variously described as darkness. See, this is part of a response to your question about dark. That figure was an element of darkness. Jesus was an element of light. Now, when Jesus walks out and here materializes this figure, what then happened? You remember the story? A very dramatic encounter between these two figures. And the Satan figure, let's call him that, said, this is amazing. You're the Son of God. Why, think what you can do now. This is incredible. Son of God. Why, I think if you wanted, you could even turn these stones to bread. Think what you could do with that. And you know the answer. What was the answer? Not yet. Not yet. That's coming. Yeah. Man cannot live by bread alone. That's a philosophical, spiritual answer.